Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Jesse Bell, your host for this week. Next week we will be joined again by Dinah Jansen. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, and it covers the City of Kingston's request for the redistribution of provincial and federal tax dollars to fund municipal infrastructure development.
Kingston has joined the growing number of municipalities requesting a portion of the provincial land transfer tax and goods and service tax go to municipalities as a source of steady infrastructure funding. Currently, municipalities do not receive a share of the provincial land transfer tax, collected by the Ontario government on property transactions to municipalities. The same goes for GST, collected by the federal government. The motion that came before council on Tuesday states the current sources of municipal revenue, including property taxes and user fees, are insufficient to meet growing infrastructure needs, including work on roads, bridges, public transit, water systems, and other critical services. The importance of predictable and sustainable funding, allowing for better planning and long-term infrastructure initiatives, is also stressed in the request. Councillor Ryan Boehm, who brought the motion forward, had the following to say.
It's as simple as what it says. We know we're struggling. Good example, police budgets are going up. Everything seems to be going up, and revenues seem to be stagnating or not keeping up. So this is just one more way that we can join a chorus of other municipalities in asking for sustained funding from the province.
As Councillor Boehm mentioned, many other municipalities, including Durham, Aurora, Loyalist, and Brantford, have made the same request. Councillor Connie Glenn, who was attending the meeting remotely while at a conference hosted by the Ontario Federation of Municipalities, spoke to the importance of establishing sustainable funding and larger conversations happening amongst municipal leaders.
I'm actually at Advocacy Days right now with the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, and so a new municipal growth framework is one of the key things that we're discussing. So this dovetails into that. I'm not sure if this will be the way that it goes, but sustainable funding is really what's on the table here. We are talking about all the other pressing needs that municipalities have, but at the end of the day, it comes back to what can be funded. So there has been, I think, some very honest discussion already that whether it's this government remains or whether we have a new government after the following election, that we're likely not to see as much movement as we would hope on the fiscal front. So one of the pressing things that we're trying to get across is that if we aren't getting that much of an increase in funding, that we at least get sustainable funding.
The motion passed unanimously, and a copy of the request was forwarded to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Premier Doug Ford, as well as other relevant officials and all 444 municipalities in Ontario. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Next, I'll be reading a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the implementation of Next Generation 911 in Gananoque. Gananoque's implementation of Next Generation 911 is in the works. Last week, Council unanimously authorized the mayor and clerk to sign an Ontario Transfer Payment Agreement, or TPA, regarding a funding grant in the amount of $491,389 for Next Generation 911. The existing 911 system has been in place for more than 30 years and has reached the end of its life, Council heard. The Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunication Commission, or CRTC, has directed that emergency telecommunication networks and 911 call centers transition to the new Next Generation 911 model by March 4th, 2025. Once fully implemented, the new Next Generation system will make it easier to provide additional details about emergency situations, such as video from the scene of an accident and the ability to text 911 when requesting immediate help from police, fire, or ambulance services. It will also give emergency operators and dispatchers the ability to identify the location of a call using GPS coordinates, resulting in a safer, faster, and more informed emergency response. The changeover from the current system to the Next Generation system comes at a major financial cost to the town. However, staff have been seeking out quotations and applying for grant opportunities. The Ontario government has already earmarked $208 million to help municipalities transition to next-generation 911 technology. The grant for the town of Gananoque began on April 1, 2024, and will conclude March 31, 2025, covering the costs of implementation. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Next, I'll be reading a story from the local Journalism Initiative reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about the pending merger of three local health units to create Southeast Public Health. Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington Public Health have voted in favor of merging with two other nearby health units, making use of an incentive program put forward by the Ontario Ministry of Health in August 2023. KFL&A Public Health will merge with Hastings Prince Edward Public Health and Leeds Grenville and Lanark District Health Unit to form Southeast Public Health. With the expectation that those units will vote in favor of a merger, Southeast Public Health will come into existence on January 1, 2025, following a brief legislative process. Dr. Peter Oglaza, Medical Officer of Health and CEO of KFL&A Public Health, said in March that a merger won't change things operationally for local health units, and that its main objective will be to find efficiencies that can be taken advantage of through the sharing of resources. The three health units voted in favor of exploring a merger in March, and last week, the Government of Ontario announced four proposals for voluntary mergers had been accepted, with Southeast Public Health being one recipient of funding. In total, across Ontario, nine local public health units will be condensed into four. Dr. Oglaza will be named Medical Officer of Health and CEO for the newly merged unit, while Dr. Ethan Tumache and Dr. Lina Lee will both be named Deputy Medical Officers of Health. Dr. Hugh Guan will remain in his role as Associate Medical Officer of Health. A Board of Health with representatives from each former health unit will be announced in the new year. Thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Over to the local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJAI-FM, Ted Evans, with a story about BGC Southeast's year-end update.
BGC Southeast, formerly the Boys and Girls Club of Kingston, shared its year-end update with Loyalist Township Council. The update focused on BGC's growth this year, as well as going forward as the partnership continues. The township entered into a five-year agreement with BGC Southeast in 2022 for the delivery of day camps. This year, summer day camps were offered in Amherstview and Bath, but not in Odessa due to a lack of a suitable location. Chief Executive Officer with BGC Southeast, Harold Parsons, explains how they're looking to grow next year.
Although we're making some headway, we know there's more to do. And we're happy that since we changed our name to BGC Southeast, that Amherstview is very much in the fold of where we see as a service delivery opportunity. That combined with expanding our Big Brothers Big Sisters to a lot of different smaller communities and schools will continue to be our strategic plan over the next year.
Parsons notes how the Big Brothers Big Sisters program has grown.
We oversee finance admin and fund development for Big Brothers Big Sisters. So every employee that works for that organization is frontline and service delivery. As a result, we've seen more than triple the numbers of children served. We've more than tripled the budget for the organization. And we've now been able to go into communities that the Boys and Girls Club were not able to before. And we've particularly expanded Big Brothers Big Sisters and Loyalist Township through in-school mentoring. And that's been great to see in the synergies and working with families and children that have greater needs for support as well.
Parsons explains that day camps are still part of their plans.
We do know that summer camps are still needed and in demand. And we know that Odessa in particular has been some challenges because of school renovations and so on over the last couple of years. But certainly in our plans this year would be programming for the summertime in Bath, Amherstview, and Odessa. And we also know that we're getting feedback from Amherst Island as well about what can we do there and how do we support children that live on the island.
Parsons describes how the partnership has helped their aquatic programs in the area.
We've stepped up when the swimming pool was down for renovations, and we're really happy to have Loyalist Township as a partner for aquatics. We see the partnership here as great as we do any other municipality, and because of our proximity, you know, we're again more than happy to see the number of families we've been able to serve.
Parson spoke about the success of day camps this year in Loyalist Township.
This year's summer camp in Amherstview and Bath have been very successful, almost 93% to 94% filled. You know, we've had 19 staff, the majority that live in Loyalist Township work for us in those areas. And we've been able to provide a lot of families with subsidies, almost $20,000, to make sure those children can attend a camp at either no fee or a greatly reduced fee.
Parsons notes the programs that BGC offers and their impact.
When we talk about impact, we start to say, okay, you know, at what point do you go from having all these children after school to how can you start to measure what you're doing in your communities that you're delivering services to? We go back to a few things. We think that there's some critical opportunities that are lacking. One of them is in literacy. So we actually have partnered and we now have acquired the Reading Clinic, which is a one-on-one multi-sensory literacy approach for children that are dyslexic or below the reading curve. And we've been doing that for about 6 years now. And we implement that into all of our programs so that children that come to the club as early as kindergarten have been giving an advantage to reading.
Parsons describes what the club does for families and touches on the growth they've experienced.
When you look at the club, you think about what parents may need. If they need daycare because they're going to work or they're in school, if they're looking for a place after school for their children for the same purposes, or for enhancement for programs for their children as well. Our programs consist of physical activity, of some education supports, and health and nutrition. And, you know, I'm pretty happy to talk about our numbers and our growth because they've been continuing to expand year after year.
Parsons speaks about their decisions as a business and fees that they help families cover.
Although we're an incorporated not-for-profit, we also very much look at ourselves as a business. And we look at our programs that we deliver. And the only qualifier we have is that no child is denied access due to inability to pay. But we provide services and we charge fees that are different depending on what they might be.
Parsons describes a service that BGC Southeast decided to not continue.
Since 2014, we moved into the new space in the Frontenac Mall. We've been providing transportation for families from three local schools in Amherst on our busing system to come to the site. And that's been great. And you know, we would have as many as 20 to 40 children come. But we also were talking about expansion and growth and serving communities as well. And then we thought, well, how can we take children from a community, bring them into another site, then try to develop programs in that community? It just really doesn't make sense.
Parsons explains why they ended this service.
This past year, it wasn't necessarily a popular decision. But we did decide that for this school year that we would no longer provide transportation from Amherst U to Kingston, but we would deliver an after-school program in Amherst U. And it took us a lot of work to get it started, but we think the potential and the growth will be substantial. So we're happy to be in Amherst U Public School, and we have children from the three of the local elementary schools being served there, but we can only see that as growing in the future. But again, mindset of if you want to develop in a community, then you have to be in the community. And we made that happen this year.
Parsons provides a breakdown of the club and their programs.
Our club is broken down in sort of two ways. One is that we operate licensed programs in your area with Lark, who does a great job and provide licensed childcare and after-school programs. We do that in two locations in Kingston. We also are the early on provider in Kingston as well, in partnership with KCHC. But where we come into play here is that we've also started to look at what we call, refer to as authorized recreation. And that is in communities that either have high priority needs that may not need a licensed program or a daycare setting, but there's opportunities for children from ages 4 to 18 to be served and provided services. Our authorized recreation programs, they include two high priority schools in Rideau Heights in Kingston, in Joyceville, in Harrowsmith, and in Amherst U. And that's a way that we're able to start delivering after school programs at a low fee to parents, but also start to meet some of the needs in the community as well.
Parsons noted the local public response they've received.
A lot of the families that are accessing, that are residents in Loyalist Township, they certainly are letting us know that they appreciate programming and additional programming in their community.
Parsons speaks about the partnership with Loyalist Township.
We have a great relationship with the Recreation Department, and you know, we're here to support and to do as much or as little as I think council or Loyalist Township staff would see us. But we're a resource there, and you know, we're here to support the community, and we believe that children It doesn't matter where they live. It's our mission vision to support as much as we can.
Parsons provides a history of the club.
It started in 1993, incorporated primarily for the highest needs that the community of Kingston established at the time, which was primarily the Real Heights community. The club started to help children and youth that were disadvantaged, whether that meant financially or in a household that didn't have the same resources and opportunities as others in the community. It's also seen as a way to reduce crime by giving mentorship and youth opportunities to be in a safe environment.
Councillor Paul Broderick spoke about his experience with the program and how it's been important locally.
One of the first programs started at St. Pat's in 1993, and I was the principal at the time, and to see the growth is amazing. And I think the most important thing I get out of it is that the number of kids, at least from that St. Pat's community, that became sort of mentors, and I think that's what makes the program unique. And the reading clinic, from an educator's point of view, that's unbelievable, because I know schools at this time, it's hard to support those things.
Mayor Jim Hagedorn shared his support for the partnership and appreciation for the work they're doing to grow.
It's great to see the new programs. I guess it's been a couple of years now since I toured it, and some of the photos that I saw there, they were still in the dream spot, I guess, at that time, and working towards them. So it's really great to see them come to fruition and being utilized.
For the 2024-2025 school year, BGC Southeast is offering a new after-school program at Amherstview Public School, available to all children ages 4 to 12 years of age. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Next is the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about a provincial honor being awarded to a museum in Prince Edward County.
Prince Edward County has several small museums located across the area, but the Macaulay Church Museum was recently highlighted when it was awarded the 2024 Ontario Museum Association Award of Excellence in Special Projects. The award was won for the exhibit A Path Forward, that is an interactive exhibit exploring truth and reconciliation in the county and focuses on the shared past, present, and future of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in the area. Curator Jessica Chase talks about the award and the collaborative effort with partners.
You must be very proud of this award that you've just received for the museum.
Yes, we are very excited about it. I think as a museum professional and attending Ontario Museum Association conferences for many years, always watching the award ceremony was really interesting and wanting to be a part of that, you know, because winning one of those awards, it indicates that you've achieved something really, really great and inspiring. And I think that the A Path Forward exhibit and our partnership with Jijunhet Ungwawana and the Downey Wenjack Fund is something that we're, as a team, incredibly proud of. We're so excited to see where it goes. But I will say we were very surprised when we received the award, because we're only 1 year into this project and there's still so much that we want to accomplish. So we're really thrilled to have this recognition so early in the exhibit's life. And we hope that it will obviously bring more eyes to it and they can watch it grow. You know, our visitors can watch it grow just as we will watch it grow over time.
I asked Jessica about the exhibit, A Path Forward.
A Path Forward is a response to the calls to action, of course. But the idea of moving reconciliation forward and doing it collaboratively. So working together, Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in our community, on a project that is positive, you know, goes forward with that mindset that we are working towards something good. We are acknowledging the errors, the bad of the past. You know, we're acknowledging trauma, we're acknowledging what has happened. We're certainly writing about the, you know, the history and the presence, historic presence and up to the present day of Indigenous people in our community. But also, yeah, what does our collective future, and it's meant to be hopeful. That's kind of our our dream. Yeah. It's meant to be really a jumping off point. Certainly the narrative anyway, is meant to be, you know, we couldn't possibly write everything. Mm-hmm. So this is really a good basis of knowledge for people. We hope that they will go and continue to do their own research, and that they will, yeah, take it upon themselves to do something, right? Yeah. Actually do something, do your own act of reconciliation. And reconciliation is not just, I say in the conclusion, you know, it's not just one big gesture. Like, it's not the grand gesture of removing a statue and then, oh, it's done. It's like, it's a million things that we can do, small, great and small, that help move that action forward. There is a phrase that kind of goes around a little bit too, that, you know, it took however many years to get us here, to do the damage, right? If we think about contact with the arrival of European settlers, and then it will take equally as much time to undo, right? This isn't something that we can achieve overnight. It is ongoing. And people can just be more conscious of that, you know, going forward in their day-to-day life.
We chatted about the importance of relationships and how trust is needed to strengthen the connection moving forward.
If anyone is approaching those relationships in really bad faith, right, is not coming forward with a good heart, a good mind, pure intentions, if it's just being done to check a box, like, oh, box yeah. checking drives me nuts. And that's why, like, this exhibit and any of the relationships that the museums have been lucky enough to build with Indigenous organizations are the result of years of communication and building trust. It is not, you know, you can't just meet someone and expect that you're going to be able to ask them for something or do, it's just relationships. It's literally just relationships. And a lot of organizations, and especially governments, they want so badly to tick the box, but they don't spend the time to build those relationships in a genuine manner that would build that trust.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over now to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Cobourg, Dan Jones, with a story about the 2025 Ontario Curling Championships.
The best curlers in the province will face off next month at the Cobourg Community Centre for the rights to represent Ontario at the Tournament of Hearts and the Brier. 12 men's and 12 women's teams will square off in a week of action starting January 19th. I spoke with Jeff Gilmer and Ian Hartford, members of the organizing committee, with Gilmer explaining why the West Northumberland Curling Club wanted to host this tournament.
Well, Curling Ontario came to us back in April and asked us if we'd be willing to host again because a previous site was having difficulty and weren't going to be able to host it. So us having been involved in 2017, Curling Ontario came to us and asked if we'd be willing to do it again. And we talked about it amongst ourselves, and we talked about it with our membership at the West Northumberland Curling Club, and we came to the conclusion that we could host this event for 2025.
Now, obviously, in April, did you guys feel you're under the gun to get this organized properly?
Well, in 2017, we worked for close to 2 years to host the event. We didn't have as much time this time, so it affected some ways, but we're just trying to use the blueprint that we used in 2017 to hopefully host another successful event.
So then talk about 2017 to the 2025 event. What did you learn from that to this event that you could implement, maybe enhance it?
Well, one thing, it's going to be a different type of event because this year in 2025, the Ontario Championship will be a triple knockout. So there'll be 12 ladies teams, 12 men's teams, both playing a triple knockout to come up with an eventual champion. The ladies' winner, of course, goes to the Canadian Tournament of Hearts, and the men's winner goes to the Canadian Brier National Championships. 12 teams, 12 ladies' teams, 12 men's teams. In 17, we had eight ladies' teams and eight men's teams. 2017 was one of the first times that the championships, Ontario Championship, hosted both the men's and ladies simultaneously. And here we're going to do it again in 2025.
Now, obviously, are you doing 8-end games, 10-end games?
The games will be 10 end games.
Okay, Ian, in terms of fan experience, what can fans expect to see on the site at any given day during the tournament?
Each day there will be three different draws, 9 o'clock, 2 o'clock, and 7 o'clock during the day. And there will be anywhere from 3 to 4 games going on during those times. And it'll be both mixed of men and women curling.
So in terms of ice preparation, how many rinks is the curling club going with? And what level of preparation is needed to install ice there?
So there will be 4 sheets of ice being laid down on top of the hockey ice. And we'll start on Thursday prior and convert that hockey ice into those 4 sheets and be ready for curling to start on Sunday evening.
Now, I understand that there's some television and broadcasting that will be going on. Can you explain who you're partnering with and what the experience will be for that?
So Curling Ontario has partnered with Cogeco, and Cogeco will be broadcasting one of the games for each of the draws, and they'll be live streaming all 4 games if there's 4 games going on at that time.
So how exciting is that to have Cogeco broadcasting these games? I mean, was that done in 2017?
The broadcasting that was done for 2017 was there was some live streaming. And I mean, back 2017, it was sort of, you know, new to technology, and who could actually watch the games was limited. This time, with technology increases, there'll be more live streaming available, and the television broadcasting is like terrific, as we'll have like anybody in Ontario that's on Cogeco will be able to watch the game from home.
Okay, Jeff, ticket sales. I know the tickets are on sale right now. First off, where could people go to get tickets?
OntarioCurlingChamps.ca is one site. The other site is Experience Cobourg. The Cobourg is our main sponsor. The town of Cobourg is the primary sponsor for the event. So tickets are available there. You can buy a whole event package. You can buy just a championship weekend package. Now tickets are available on a daily basis as well. And it even breaks it down to just one draw as well. So all tickets are available now for January 19th to the 26th.
So what uptick are you seeing in ticket sales right now?
Ticket sales have been off to a very good start. They started earlier in November, and everything's available as of Black Friday. Ticket sales have been going very well. Teams are still to be decided who will be the top 12 women's and the top 12 men's teams in Ontario. So once those teams are announced and decided, we think we'll see an expansion in the ticket sales. But they've started out very well, and they make a great Christmas gift. So we were successful with that promotional approach in 17, and we're hopefully successful again, and we'll get a lot of people from Port Hope and Cobourg and from Northumberland County coming to the event.
This is Dan Jones reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Dan Jones from CFWN Cobourg for that story. Up next, the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, December 12th, chilliest day of the week here in the city of Kingston. We've got a daytime high of -5 with a 40% chance of flurries, dropping down to -11 overnight. Friday, December 13th, staying consistent with that -4, -5 daytime high, dropping down to -7 overnight. Saturday, December 14th, we have a daytime high of -1 with a 40% chance of flurries throughout the day, dropping a single degree to -2 overnight. Sunday, December 15th, ending off the week with a daytime high of 1 degree, so around that freezing mark, and a 60% chance of flurries. And then as we move into the start of next week, Monday, December 16th, we're going to see a high of around 5 degrees, and that will stay consistent into the next day as Tuesday, December 17th, we have a projected high of 8 degrees. So some unseasonably warm weather after this period of wet and chilly weather.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. We'll